Question. Is there really an end to this world? Answer by the Master. The day each person dies is the end of the world for that person. The power of insight. Dharma wealth is lost, and merit and virtue both destroyed, due to none other than the conscious mind. Through the door of concentration, the self-conscious, clever, wily mind does cease. That mind is ended. Suddenly one then enters into the power of insight, into knowledge of the unproduced. That's a quote from the Song of Enlightenment by Great Master Yongja. We cultivators of the way cannot afford to lose our Dharma wealth or destroy our merit and virtue. If Dharma wealth is lost, we won't have any wealth or blessings to speak of. If merit and virtue are destroyed, then we end up severing our own good roots. Instead, we should daily deepen our wealth of Dharma and daily increase our merit and virtue. Then our cultivation will bring about some response. Why is Dharma wealth lost? And why is merit and virtue destroyed? For no other reason than that people are constantly using the mind, intellect, and consciousness. They use the mind to calculate, the intellect to guess and speculate, and the consciousness to make discriminations. People stay incredibly busy, calculating, speculating, and discriminating nonstop. Since most people put their effort into exclusively using the mind, intellect, and consciousness, they end up losing their Dharma wealth and destroying merit and virtue. Investigating Chan meditation is called stilling one's thoughts. It means training our thoughts not to move, but to be quiet and still instead. The method of meditation aspires to the highest attainment. It is a practice designed to penetrate the true mind directly. We separate from the activities of mind, intellect, and consciousness in our cultivation of Chan meditation. For this reason, the verse says the mind does cease. The mind here also includes the intellect and consciousness. We have to put a complete stop to the activity of those false states of mind. Only then can we be considered to have stilled our thoughts. If we manage to still our thoughts, then suddenly we can enter into the power of insight, into knowledge of the unproduced. We can obtain patience with the non-production of dharmas and be certified to the four stages of warmth, summit, patience, and foremost in the world. 1. Warmth is the stage where we start to generate some heat from our investigation during meditation. 2. Summit indicates that our skill has reached the highest level, the crown of our head. 3. Patience means that sustaining that state is very hard to bear. Nonetheless, we are able to sustain it. 4. Foremost in the world indicates that we become a great hero in the world and beyond. If you wish to realize these four positions, the very first thing you have to learn is how to still your thoughts. This means not being turned by your mind, intellect, or consciousness. Our thoughts are like waves in the ocean. They come up one after another and never stop. Now we must learn to stop them, to still our thoughts. When stillness reaches the extreme point, we bring forth wisdom. Once wisdom is produced, there is penetrating light. For this reason, we say, when stillness reaches the extreme point, the light breaks through. This is also the meaning of the line, suddenly One then enters in, into the power of insight, into knowledge of the unproduced. If you are able to put an end to the activity of your mind, intellect, and consciousness, you will open up great wisdom. Therefore, cultivators of the way need not look for the esoteric or pursue spiritual powers. Once the stillness of your mind reaches the ultimate point, you will naturally produce great wisdom. And then you will be able to slice right through any problem that comes your way. When you have wisdom, you will no longer be upside down. This is the first step in sitting in Chan meditation. Therefore, when you sit, be sure not to engage in false thinking. Seek to still your thoughts and bring them to a complete stop. Verse by Master Hua, The Way to Cultivate. A vast proper spirit needs to be nurtured. Firm resolve sustains the way and righteousness. Never miss, never forget, and take no shortcuts. Know yourself, know others, and the way will prevail. Vast and Proper Energy. An essay by Master Hua. Vast and proper energy pervades the Dharma realm. It encompasses the myriad things and shines throughout all time, illumining both past and present. It is the mother of truth, goodness, and beauty, and the vanquisher of falseness, evil, and ugliness. If heaven and earth were without it, they would not be fit to be heaven and earth. If sages and worthies were without it, they could not be called sages and worthies. If rulers and high officials are without it, they are not qualified to be rulers and high officials. If ordinary people obtain it, they turn into sages. If sages and worthies increase in it, they can become Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Therefore, this vast and proper energy is the stairway to Buddhahood. Now the master explains the essay. Vast and proper energy pervades the Dharma realm. Vast means so great there is nothing greater, and proper means not having any deviant energy. You should understand that vast and proper energy is free from all personal desires. If it has the least bit of personal desire or defiled thinking, fighting, greed, seeking, selfishness, self-benefiting, or lying in it, then it is deviant, not proper energy. Vast and proper energy is the incredibly great energy that sustains all between heaven and earth. All sages, worthies, and Buddhas come forth from this proper energy. Since it is not located either inside, outside, or in between, you could call it the human mind or the soul of the myriad things which sustains everything. In Confucianism, it is called vast and proper energy. One could call it the Buddha nature, but most people would not understand what that means. Vast and proper energy does not come from inside, outside, or in between. It extends throughout the Dharma realm and is neither excessive nor deficient. Everyone has it, and no one lacks it. And no one has either more or less of it than anyone else. Sages do not have more of it than ordinary people. It's just that ordinary people are unable to use it, whereas sages are able to use it. Consider a person who studies. He is the same person whether he studies or not, but if he doesn't study, he won't have the same kind of knowledge he would have if he learned what was in those books. Vast and proper energy is something you nurture. It develops from the five constants, which are humaneness, righteousness, propriety, wisdom, and trustworthiness. Embodying these, we gradually nurture our vast and proper energy, rendering it full and complete. That vast and proper energy connects with all the myriad existing things between heaven and earth, and it pervades the Dharma realm. The Dharma realm itself is all-pervasive, and so is vast and proper energy. The essay continues, "It encompasses the myriad things and shines throughout all time, illumining both past and present. It includes everything, whether of proper or deviant energy. Even demonic ghosts and goblins have vast and proper energy, but they cannot use it properly, only improperly. If used properly, correctly, and appropriately, then it is vast and proper energy. Used incorrectly, it is deviant energy. That is how it encompasses the myriad existing things. Even demonic ghosts possess it, although they are unable to use it. Vast and proper energy is totally equitable, without the least bit of partiality or favoritism. Vast and proper energy is always luminous, its light pervading everywhere, and so the Buddha nature illumines both past and present. If we can use vast and proper energy, then a kind of light is emitted. The light comes from humaneness, righteousness, refraining from sexual misconduct, not lying and not taking intoxicants. Not killing is humaneness. Not stealing is righteousness. Refraining from sexual misconduct is propriety. Not lying is trustworthiness. And not taking intoxicants is wisdom. Humaneness, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom come from the mind. They are developed from the mind, based on the mind, and exist within the human mind. Vast and proper energy is very stern and unmoving. It is not the least bit casual in any situation or toward anyone, no matter who. There is absolutely no favoritism involved. An iron face is shown to all with no courtesies or polite talk, no fussiness or demeaning behavior. If riches and honor cannot make you decadent, you have vast and proper energy. If poverty and lowliness cannot change you, you have vast and proper energy. If force cannot make you succumb, you have vast and proper energy. Not becoming debauched by wealth and honor, and happy although poor and of low station, means one is sustained by vast and proper energy. As the saying goes, untainted by wealth and honor, happy though poor and lowly, humane even to the point of death, a true hero. Nurturing this vast and proper energy, then, starts from practicing humaneness, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom. From them develop beauty, greatness, sageliness, and spirituality. Mencius said, "Humaneness, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom have their base in the mind. They produce a coloration that appears on the face, can be seen from the back, and extends throughout the four limbs." If you are full of humaneness, rectitude, propriety, and wisdom, your face will naturally have an air of kindness and compassion, of wholesomeness and goodness. It will show on your entire body, and your four limbs will speak without words. Without your having to say anything, everyone will understand. The essay continues, "It is the mother of truth, goodness, and beauty, and the vanquisher of falseness, evil, and ugliness." Truth, goodness, and beauty come from vast and proper energy. If you have vast and proper energy, then you will have truth, goodness, and beauty. And so it is their mother. If you do things in a phony, untrue way, you are being false. If others are good, but you do evil, or if you do evil and make trouble within the good you do, you may think you are going to become famous and rich, but actually, you are being very ugly, and people recognize it. As soon as they see the way you are, they are sure to look down on you. They know you completely fail to understand the Dharma and are only using effort on the surface. If you have vast and proper energy, you won't have falseness, evil, and ugliness. And if you have falseness, evil, and ugliness, you won't have vast and proper energy. The essay says, if heaven and earth were without it, they would not be fit to be heaven and earth. Lacking vast and proper energy, heaven and earth would not be adequate to being heaven and earth. The essay says, if sages and worthies were without it, they could not be called sages and worthies. If sages and worthies lacked this vast and proper energy, they would not deserve to be called sages and worthies. If proper and superior people were without it, they would not be proper and superior people. If someone seems proper and superior but actually lacks vast and proper energy, then he would not really be a proper and superior person. He would simply be cheating the world and stealing a false reputation. The essay says, if rulers and high officials are without it, they are not qualified to be rulers and high officials. If the leaders of countries, the chiefs of state, the high-ranking ministers and officials lack vast and proper energy, they are harming people. That is because without proper energy, they are only concerned with benefiting themselves and achieving position and fame. The essay says, if ordinary people obtain it, they turn into sages. If ordinary, everyday people understand this vast and proper energy, they can become sages, reversing the ordinary so that it becomes sagely. The essay says, if sages and worthies increase in it, they can become Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. If people who are already sages and worthies can go on to increase their vast and proper energy by tending and nurturing it further, they can become Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Someone who does nothing all day but chatter and gossip will never achieve sagehood. Such a person does not understand vast and proper energy, but is full of deviant energy. The essay says, therefore, this vast and proper energy is the stairway to Buddhahood. If you want to become a Buddha, you first must have vast and proper energy. To have vast and proper energy is the foundation for going to the land of ultimate bliss and for recognizing your original face. Now there's a verse. Vast and proper energy nurtures Qian and Kun, the male and female. From past to present, at home and abroad, only this is true. It is great and solid to the utmost, nurtured and not harmed. It illumines heaven, illumines earth, and establishes all creatures. It fills the six directions, spreading to worlds as many as grains of sand. It includes the myriad things, pervading lands as many as dust motes. Tend and irrigate it well. It is the seed of Bodhi. Do not neglect or help it. It is ultimately without a trace. The verse says, vast and proper energy nurtures the Qian and Kun. Qian and Kun can mean men and women, and in general refer to the yang and yin, which produce heaven, earth, and the myriad things, as well as worthies, Buddhas, and sagely people. They all come forth from vast and proper energy. The verse says, from past to present, at home and abroad, only this is true. At home and abroad could also mean inside and outside. Anything lacking vast and proper energy will not last. Only what has vast and proper energy endures. Whatever has it can remain forever in the world. If you are in the world but lack vast and proper energy, it would be better for you to die fast, since your deviant energy harms the world. You are here just doing things for your own advantage, always looking for benefit for yourself. Believing in the Buddha is in order to benefit other people, not only to benefit oneself or to gain an advantage for oneself. The verse says, "It is great and solid to the utmost, nurtured and not harmed." Mencius said, "I well nurture my vast and proper energy." Vast and proper energy is what allows one to be fearless, not fearing heaven, not fearing earth, and not fearing the ghosts and spirits. With vast and proper energy, one has no fear of demonic ghosts and goblins. There is nothing greater or stronger, nothing more dynamic. However, you must nurture it well. Don't let the least bit of personal desire remain within it. Don't be selfish and looking for a way to benefit yourself. If you can't stand the least bit of hardship, can't stand the tiniest amount of suffering, can't bear to be even slightly hungry or thirsty, then your vast and proper energy goes flat. A popular Manchurian term for people like this is flattened eggplants. You should tend and nurture your vast and proper energy. If you have deviant energy, then you lack vast and proper energy, and that is what is meant by harming it. The verse says, "It illumines heaven, illumines earth, and establishes all creatures." If you nurture it well, it will emit light which shines throughout heaven and earth and can benefit all living beings, all your fellow creatures. The verse says, "It fills the six directions, spreading to worlds as many as grains of sand." This vast and proper energy fills the entire Dharma realm, extending throughout worlds as numerous as grains of sand in the Ganges River. The verse goes on, "It includes the myriad things, pervading lands as many as dust motes." Vast and proper energy is everywhere. It's just that you are unable to use it. The verse says, "Tend and irrigate it well. It is the seed of Bodhi." Vast and proper energy is the Buddha nature, and you need to tend and cultivate it. The verse says, "Do not neglect or help it. It is ultimately without a trace." You shouldn't forget about it, but you also shouldn't assist it like the man of Song who pulled up his sprouts trying to get them to grow faster. That won't work either. Don't neglect it, but don't try to get it to grow quickly. It should be very natural, without any traces. All you have to do is get rid of your deviant energy, rid yourself of selfishness and self-benefiting attitudes and shameless behavior, and that will be sufficient. That is why it is ultimately without a trace. There is no deliberate application of effort involved. It is what Mencius was talking about when he said, "Fullness of truth is beauty. Fullness of truth with radiance is greatness. Greatness that can transform is sageliness. Sageliness which cannot be known is spirituality." His fullness of truth refers to fullness of essence, energy, and spirit, which makes one a beautiful person. Fullness of truth conjoined with radiance is greatness. If your essence, your energy, and your spirit are full and complete, and in addition you can emit light, then you have some vast and proper energy and are a great person. He says, "Greatness which can transform is sageliness." If you are great and also have the wonderful functioning of spiritual penetrations, then you are a sagely person. He says, sageliness, which cannot be known, is spirituality. If you reach the point that even sages do not know, then you are a spiritual person. Vast and proper energy is the foundation for that. Question: what exactly is Dharma? Answer by the Master: Dharma means energy. Energy that can penetrate heaven and earth. All Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all of us are one because our energies are connected. Chan at all times. Investigating Chan meditation, we sit in the same hall together, but in actuality, Chan is not only practiced when we sit. We should be investigating Chan at all times, in all aspects of our behavior. Walking, standing, sitting, and lying down, do not be apart from this. If we part from this, then we have gone amiss. Well, what is this? It is the stilling of our thoughts. If we can quiet our thoughts, then we will have attained concentration. When our thoughts reach a single focus, we can be successful in everything we do. Why is it that people don't have success in what they do? They have not yet attained concentration. When we can be completely focused, then we gain concentration. And from concentration, we will develop wisdom. Sitting in Chan, we don't want to seek spiritual penetrations or any kind of special effect. First and foremost, we should try to clean up our bodies so that we won't have any kind of illness. With strong and healthy bodies, deviant energies won't have a way to encroach upon us. If we are able to maintain a vast, flowing, proper energy that soars to the heavens and stabilizes the earth, then we will naturally give rise to proper concentration, knowledge, and vision, and everything we do will be principled and rational. That is one of the benefits of sitting in Chan meditation. If we do not let the waves of thoughts well up in our minds, then at all times we will not experience afflictions, including feelings of right and wrong and awareness of self and others. Right there, we are getting the benefit of investigating Chan. First, we should turn the light inward and examine ourselves. Am I still as gluttonous as I was before I started to sit in meditation? Am I still as concerned with seeking fame as I used to be? Have I changed my faults? When I encounter unreasonable situations or things that don't go my way, do I get all upset over them? If the answer to any or all of those questions is yes, then that shows us we haven't made much progress in our Chan meditation. But if we can correct our personality defects and lessen our faults, then we are getting some good news and we can proceed to examine ourselves further. In eating, are we able to eat delicious food and bad-tasting food and treat them just the same? If so, we can chase out the ghost of gluttony. In work, do we only do the things that are advantageous to us and completely ignore things that would bring us no direct advantage? Are we lazy? Do we try to scrimp on materials or waste time? If so, then we have no skill to speak of. If we can manage to change so that we are willing to help with things that are a benefit to others, so that we like serving the public and are no longer so egocentric, then we have expelled the ghost of laziness. In making an effort, are we able to become more and more energetic every day? When we are no longer groggy and moving around as if in a daze, then we have driven out the ghost of drowsiness. If we succeed in driving out the ghost of gluttony, the ghost of laziness, and the ghost of sleep, then we have made the first step in our cultivation of Chan meditation. We must make a definite change from before, turn over a new leaf, and become a totally new person. As the saying goes, the temple is the same, but the resident spirit is different. Or in this case, we could say the temple is the same, but the resident ghost is different. Before, a ghost king dwelled in our temple. Now, it is a bodhisattva. Maybe in the past we had an evil and poisonous heart, but now we've brought forth the compassionate heart of a bodhisattva. Basically, just by the way we eat, we can tell whether or not we have skill in Chan meditation. If we are still obsessed with good flavors, and we are picky when it comes to choosing good food, then we haven't derived any benefit from Chan. We must get rid of our past faults, habits, and afflictions, especially our tempers. If we can get rid of affliction, then it's like sediment that settles to the bottom of the water. When the water clears up and we are able to see from the top right to the bottom, right at that time, our wisdom will surface. If our mind is always turbid and we haven't swept out our afflictions and ignorance, then we won't attain any samadhi. And if we don't have samadhi, how much less can we speak of wisdom? Therefore, sitting in Chan meditation, we must have patience. If we make Chan the focus of our life, then we have to make a positive change regarding every aspect of our character and our actions. It's not the case that we cultivate meditation only when we're sitting. Rather, we are working hard at all times and in all places. After some time, silently and imperceptibly, there will be a change and a transformation, and we will have managed to remold our character. If I have spoken correctly, you can practice accordingly. If I have spoken incorrectly, then you can forget it as if you'd never heard me speak. If it is in accord with the way, progress along it. If it is against the way, retreat from it. If you still have afflictions, then all the more spur yourself on. Don't let it be the case that you come here to sit in Chan meditation, and when you go home, you blow up. If people are without a temper, they are like the Buddhas. But if they fly off into a rage, they are like ghosts. When they pout and frown, don't they look unsightly? If, on the other hand, you can be cheerful and optimistic at all times, then you have managed to turn things around. Afflictions can be transformed into bodhi, just like turning over the palm of your hand. All you have to do is turn it around. There's no need to seek outside. It's all within yourself. Question: how can we avoid hunger? Answer by the Master: if we have enough vital energy, then we will not feel hungry. With enough vitality, we can go without eating for several days without any problem. We can talk with a booming voice still. Our voice does not wane, and our health does not become poor when we don't eat. This is because we have developed our real chi, our real energy, which pours in endlessly, like running electric currents. Question: how can we avoid sleepiness? Answer by the Master: if we have enough spirit, then we will not be so sleepy. Why do we want to sleep so much? That happens because our yin energy is dominant. If our yang energy were dominant, we would sleep less. Question: why are we afraid of the cold? Answer by the Master: if we have enough essence, that is, reproductive energy, we will not be afraid of the cold. If we can keep the precepts and not violate them, we will not be afraid of the cold. There's nothing special to this. If men don't get near women and women don't get near men, we will be fine without food and can do without much clothing. How to eat, sleep, and wear clothes. Eating is a very important matter in everyone's life, as are wearing clothes and sleeping. It seems to me that since eating, wearing clothes, and sleeping are the most fundamental aspects of our lives, we should learn how to do these things properly. In that way, we won't be wasting our energy. When we eat, we shouldn't eat too fast. We shouldn't get nervous, because if we do, then we'll suffer from indigestion and all kinds of stomach complications. That's why there's this saying, sicknesses enter through the mouth. Calamities come out from the mouth. During mealtime, we should be very respectful. We should maintain an attitude of gratitude and thanksgiving, because this is a country of plenty where we are all able to get our fill. Since this is the case, we should take our meal slowly. Although eating is a necessity, we shouldn't be greedy for the flavors of food. Another saying, the superior person does not pay attention to food. He places emphasis on the way. The very best way to eat is to ignore the flavor. If you are able to do that, it will be very easy for you to digest your food, and the food won't make you sick. If we can learn to eat without being greedy for flavors, then we will also be able to apply the same principle to everything we do. Everything we do has both benefit and harm in it. Everything we do has some good and some bad in it. Everything we do has the potential for victory or defeat. In eating correctly, we should eat wholesome food in order to preserve our health. We should be very calm, natural, and at ease when we eat. It would be best not to think about other things while we eat. And if we could eliminate discursive thought altogether while we take our meal, then we could truly eat without knowing the flavor. Eating in that way would allow the food we ate to be used to its maximum potential. In a sense, we would have saved its benefits by not savoring them. Clothes are the second necessity. Our clothes should be clean. They don't have to be elegant or costly. There are many problems involved with wearing expensive clothes. You're afraid to sit down and afraid to stand up, reluctant to sit for fear that the place where you're about to sit is dirty and the expensive clothes you're wearing will get soiled. You're reluctant to stand for fear that you will brush against something that will ruin the appearance of your clothing. Wearing expensive clothes becomes as burdensome as donning armor. The clothes we wear need only be clean. This is my simple opinion. If we don't go after the best food and the finest clothes, then we will be properly managing the first two necessities. When it's time to sleep, we shouldn't think about yesterday, today, or tomorrow. Then we can sleep easily. Many people in this world rely on sleeping pills so they can go to sleep and stomach medicines so they can digest their food. Many people also never feel warm, no matter how many clothes they put on. Other people never feel cool enough, no matter how few clothes they are wearing. If we can be peaceful at heart when doing things, being in harmony with ourselves, then none of the many kinds of sicknesses will come to trouble us. My words have been very simple, and yet if you're listening, you'll find a lot about how to conduct yourself in my message. Question: what is the meaning of life? Answer by the Master: hurry up and die if you feel life is meaningless. If you feel that there is meaning to your life, then that means everything. Question: what was the Buddha's attitude toward life? Answer by the Master: one of compassion, joy, generosity, and equanimity. A way of life. The superior person does not try to get full when he eats. does not seek comfort in his dwelling, and is prompt in doing things. He is careful in his speech and follows those who have the way in order to rectify himself. Such a person can be said to really like to learn. Quote from the Confucian Analects on Learning. Confucius said that someone with virtue, who is intent upon the way, does not try to get full when he eats. Why not? The desires for food and sex are instinctive. People all like to eat well and also wish to eat their fill. If they aren't filled, they constantly feel they haven't done right by their stinking skin bags. But people who want to cultivate shouldn't try to eat so full or so well. The superior person is concerned about the way and not concerned about food. However, to go hungry is also wrong. At each meal, we should eat so we are 80% full, and that's sufficient. The remaining 20% can remain for people who have nothing to eat, so that no one in the world will have to die of starvation. But, you may say, if I leave it, can they eat it? You don't need to pay attention to that. You haven't eaten it. You haven't been a big rice-eating bug and depleted the world's resources, and so you've fulfilled your responsibility. Most people talk about eating their fill and letting it go at that, but a superior person who truly cultivates the way not only doesn't eat his fill, he fundamentally does not intend to get full. He always leaves 20 to 30% room in his stomach. A superior person also does not seek comfort in his dwelling. We cultivators don't reside in mansions. Some people may have a building that towers to the heavens, but they still don't take up more than 8 feet of it at night when they sleep. And however much good food and fine flavors are available to you, you can only eat 3 meals a day. People in our tradition only eat 1 meal a day, and so this applies even more to them. We should be content simply to have a place to live. For example, Confucius's disciple Yen Yen ate from a piece of bamboo and drank from a hollowed-out gourd. He didn't own a single teacup, let alone a teapot. The hermit Chao Fu rested in a nest. He built himself a bird's nest in a tree and lived there. He didn't even use a ladle to drink from, but scooped up water with his hands. Someone had given him a gourd, which he had hung on the tree, but it made an irritating noise when the wind blew, and so he threw it away. Those are examples of people who did not want any external possessions. A superior person is prompt in doing things. He doesn't put things off. We too should be prompt and expeditious in doing things and quickly get done with what it is we should do. However, we should not be frantic either, for excess is equivalent to deficiency, and to get nervous is also wrong. We should do things in moderation, neither overdoing nor underdoing. He is, in addition, careful with his speech. We must be very cautious in what we say. We must not casually say whatever we please. As it is said, one word can make the nation flourish, but one word can also destroy a nation. If we are over-talkative, then we aren't being careful in our speech. A superior person follows those who have the way in order to rectify himself. If we don't understand something, we should draw near a virtuous person, either someone of refinement or someone with gong fu, with skill, or someone learned. It must be a person loftier than we are. We should inquire of him, am I right or wrong? My wisdom is insufficient, and I can't tell. I lack discernment. Please tell me. Please help me know myself. Such a person is one who really likes to learn. Anyone who can be that way, who is attentive to virtue and wisdom is someone who truly wishes to learn. Question: what should we do with kitchen staff who gossip? Answer by the Master: we will eat food made of gossip. Verse by the Master: taking another step at the top of the pole. After being mindful of the Buddha, begin to meditate. Sliding down is easy. Going up is hard. If you can take another step at the top of a 100-foot pole, you will discover that beyond this world is another world. Vigor. Some people come to sit in chan meditation, and as the weeks pass, they feel they have made progress. Their bodies have gotten healthier. They feel spirited and happy. Their afflictions daily decrease while their wisdom daily increases. They're no longer worried, upset, or hateful. And these are signs of gaining skill in meditation. However, there are others who come to sit in meditation who feel restless and agitated, their wild thoughts flying everywhere. The more they sit, the more restless they become. They can't bear to sit down. Originally, they had no afflictions, but sitting there, they start to worry. Some people start to entertain thoughts of money when they sit. Others have desirous thoughts. Still others think, this is not as much fun as eating out at a restaurant. Still some others think, it would be much more comfortable if I stayed at home and slept in. So, there are these two kinds of people. The first kind are discovering their good roots. They want to build a solid foundation in Buddhism and to cultivate. If they can put down the 10,000 conditions bit by bit, their good roots will ripen, and eventually they will become Buddhas. As for the other kind, their karmic obstacles are too heavy. There's a saying, if you wish to be good, your former karmic obstacles look you up. If you wish to become a Buddha, you have to undergo the demons. Demons come to polish our nature, to refine us. They test us to see how solid our resolve is, whether or not we really want to sit in meditation. Face to face with the test, don't be turned by the situation. We should be vigorous whether we meet a pleasant or an adverse situation. Faced with a pleasant situation, we want to push forward and make progress. Faced with an adverse situation, we still want to go forward. Since we know that sitting in chan meditation has many good benefits, then even if false thoughts arrive and we find it very hard to sit still, we should be patient and continue to sit. That way, we will make progress in our skill. Making a strong commitment to attain Bodhi, in the future we will most certainly become Buddhas. Moreover, we should rely on three things to overcome all difficulties. 1. Resoluteness. Our resolve should be firm. Be unwavering and keep on working hard no matter what test arrives. 2. Sincerity. Be earnest and intent to the utmost in doing your work. Do not entertain idle thoughts. 3. Perseverance. Be unchanging and constant. If you start out with doing something, make sure you pursue it to the very end. Since you have begun to sit, you should keep on sitting until you come to some success. Then you will experience a breakthrough and reach a penetrating understanding. Only then can you end birth and death and arrive at the Buddha's position of Bodhi. Don't forget those three conditions. Don't forget to remain vigorous when faced with either pleasant or adverse situations. Those are your provisions for your journey to the Buddha's land. With them, you will most certainly arrive at your destination. And Master Hua's verse once again, don't be apart from this. Moving or still, awake or asleep, don't be apart from this. If you depart from this, then you've gone amiss. Question. Could the Venerable Master please point out the way for me? When someone is meditating, who or what is the meditator? Answer by the Master. You find out. Verse the Master used to start a Chan meditation session. Pick it up and put it down. Pick it up, put it down. Who is mindful of the Buddha? Ha, ha, ha. Put it down, pick it up. Who is the Buddha mindful of? He, he, he. It's not you, it's not me. Between you and me, there are too many people. It is you, it is me. When Mount Sumeru is knocked down, who can there be? Who? Someone has asked about the meaning behind the meditation topic, who is mindful of the Buddha? The Vajrasutra says, bring forth the mind that does not dwell anywhere. To not dwell anywhere means to not think about good or evil. We work hard in the place where there is no distinction of good or evil. To make discriminations between good and bad is to still have attachments. The whole purpose of cultivation is to get rid of all attachments, to the point that we even forget our body. If we truly forget even our own body, what attachments could we possibly have? When we are investigating Chan, we should not think of anything at all. So why is it suggested that we think of who is mindful of the Buddha? Actually, we're looking for who. When we find out who, we'll become enlightened. Before we have found out, we need to keep looking, whether for 1 day, 10 days, 100 days, 1,000 days, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, even 10,000 years, still, we must discover who. When we finally succeed in finding out who, then our job will be done. But you can't seek quick results. Using a meditation topic is not like smoking dope to get an instant hit. It's not that heady. The fast effects of drugs and stimulants only cheat people. Cultivation is a true method devoid of any deception whatsoever. But we have to really work hard at it. You can't pull on young shoots in an attempt to make them grow faster. If you do that, they will certainly die. Don't make the mistake of seeking for speed in cultivation. The meditation topic, who is mindful of the Buddha, can intercept all other thoughts. It can sever all desirous thoughts, even smash the 10 demon armies. The word who is a Vajra King's jeweled sword. It can slice through anything. But in investigating this meditation topic, we must not become attached to any physical place or state of mind we may experience in the process. And so the Vajrasutra also says, all appearances are false and empty. If you see all appearances as no appearances, then you see the Thus Come One. All attachments arise from people's thoughts. Getting rid of all attachments is what the resolve to take this path is all about. If we don't look into the topic who while sitting in meditation, it's easy for our stray thoughts to come and swamp us. If that keeps happening, we will never become enlightened. Investigating a meditation topic is fighting poison with poison. Using a single sustained thought to subdue all other thoughts. When you drill to the place where the mountains are leveled and the seas dry up, at that point you turn around. That is the moment of true awakening. Question. Master, if the law of cause and effect never errs, how can dharmas not be fixed? What does that mean? Answer by the Master. The fact that dharmas are not fixed does not mean you don't need to cultivate and that you can kill, commit arson, and rob. No fixed dharmas means that we should do no evil and do every good. We should do them, but we're not doing them. We are doing nothing, but we are doing everything. Don't be attached. Master's verse for ending a chan session: neither happy nor worried. When you're enlightened, take no delight. Before you're enlightened, harbor no worry. Just continue working hard. Hand in hand, I'll walk with you. Heroic progress. We people who cultivate the way should be extremely careful not to become self-satisfied, arrogant, or haughty. If we are self-satisfied, then we won't make progress. If we are arrogant, then we won't be able to learn from those beneath us. We should feel that what we know is very little, and we should welcome the chance to study with other people, learn from other people, seek wisdom from everyone. We should be open to both favorable and adverse situations. We should be able to accept not only pleasant states, but also unpleasant ones. We shouldn't say that we can't stand unpleasant experiences, nor should we just endure what is unpleasant and remain unreceptive to what is agreeable and pleasant. If we become attached to either extreme, then we won't be able to obtain samadhi. For example, if someone praises us and we like it, then we have been moved by the wind of compliance. If people slander us and we react to that, then we have been moved by an adverse wind. Whether situations are compliant or adverse, we should progress right through them. Both situations provide us opportunities to learn. Both can be said to be good and wise advisors. It is said that adversity creates heroes. Heroes are made from situations that are not easy to get through. When adversity comes, we should respond to it as though it were an agreeable state, and yet the same holds true for compliant states. We must recognize both these states for what they are and be careful not to go to extremes. Question: what is wisdom? Answer by the Master: wisdom is about always knowing the right thing to do and say. Full lotus posture is a golden pagoda. Chan Master Guibi's name means pressured by ghosts. Here's his story. Originally, this monk did not practice Chan meditation. He performed ceremonies. But once, when he heard some people ridiculing him for being a monk who took offerings for doing funerals, he got to thinking about that. On the same day he heard the criticism, he was walking on the road returning from a funeral when it began to rain. Disgruntled, he ducked under a bridge to try to keep dry. There he was, under the bridge, and had nothing to do. There were no dead people under the bridge, so he couldn't perform a funeral. So he thought, well, I could try meditation. I've heard that it's not bad. I'll try sitting in meditation and see what it's like. So he sat down and pulled his legs into full lotus. He got his legs all arranged and sat there, and immediately a wonderful state appeared. What state? Two ghosts appeared. Here he was, day after day, crossing over ghosts, and although he had never seen a ghost, he wasn't afraid of them. He was more or less in the retinue of ghosts. He was that far gone in his involvement with them. So when he saw the ghosts, he wasn't afraid. One ghost said, "Hey, what's a golden pagoda doing here? I've never seen that here before." The other ghost said, "Oh, a golden pagoda has the Buddha's relics in it. We better bow to it. The Buddha's Dharma body is there. So the two ghosts started bowing like chickens eating grain. They bowed over and over and over and over again. But they didn't knock their heads on the ground when they bowed because, after all, they were ghosts. There was just this yin energy there, bowing. They continued to bow in a very agitated way, standing up, bowing, standing, kneeling, bowing, and standing up. Now, since this monk was on pretty friendly terms with ghosts, he crossed them over every day, he considered all ghosts he crossed over as his special friends, and so he wasn't afraid. But soon after he had sat for a while, his legs refused to cooperate. His legs said, "It hurts, it hurts, it hurts." They started crying, "Pain, pain." As soon as they yelled, "Pain, pain," he listened to them. He listened to his legs talking to him. He said, "Fine, I'll liberate you." So he eased out of full lotus posture into half lotus. Meanwhile, the ghosts kept bowing and bowing, but once, when they looked up, they glanced at what they were bowing to, and they stopped to confer with each other. One said, "Hey, that was a golden pagoda. How did it turn into a silver one? That's really strange." The other ghost said, "Oh, what difference does it make? Gold pagoda, silver pagoda. Silver pagodas also have the Buddha's Dharma body inside. We ought to keep bowing." So they started bowing again. But by now they probably weren't as fast as chickens eating grain. They were bowing more and more slowly. They kept it up for another half hour, or maybe even an hour. Let's not quibble about how long it was. But eventually, the monk couldn't take it any longer. His legs were complaining again. They started making an uproar and screaming, "Oh, the pain is unimaginable. It hurts, it hurts, it hurts. We just can't stand the pain any longer." The legs made such a ruckus that he thought, "All right, already, I'll liberate you." So he slipped out of half lotus and just sat there in cross-legged fashion, as casual as he pleased. Well, that really woke the ghosts up. They said, "Look, that's not a golden pagoda or a silver pagoda either. Basically, it's just a mound of mud. We've really been fooled. Let's kick it. Let's kick this mound of mud." To them, the monk now sitting casually looked like a mound of mud. But as soon as he heard the ghosts were going to kick him, he immediately got back into full lotus. As soon as he got his legs crossed over each other, the ghosts blinked in astonishment and said, "Look, it's a golden pagoda again. It transformed into a gold pagoda again. We better keep bowing." So the two of them continued to bow. They bowed until dawn, until a cock crowed, and then they left. The monk mused, "Oh, full lotus is a golden pagoda. Half lotus is a silver pagoda. And sitting any way you please is a mound of mud. That's really inconceivable. Well, I've decided. From now on, I'm not going to recite for ghosts. I'm going to change my trade. I'm going to make a jeweled hall of gold for the Buddha. I'm going to become a golden pagoda." And after that, every day he sat in full lotus. After sitting for a time, he became enlightened. And after becoming enlightened, he thought, "Amazing! Who were my good and wise advisors? Turns out they were a couple of ghosts." So after that, he called himself Guibi, pressured by ghosts. The ghosts forced him into cultivating.